Station number 28933, Cyril Pierce, part 2.
Cyril, you were telling me about the prostitutes before the war.
The euphemism for prostitute is Tom. It still is, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. So, and it's much easier to say Tom than keep on saying prostitute. But they were, in a lot of cases, women who were not at all pretty, and some of them were really ugly. I remember walking through Wardour Street with a police friend of mine, we were in civvies, and we were propositioned by a Tom, and we of course refused that. And when we went on, my friend said to me, he said, I wouldn't ever even use in your pee, your prick. So that'll have to come out with it. but they weren't bad girls, really. There was one or two really vicious ones, and they were simply earning a living. It was, by the way, I don't know whether it still is, an offence to gossip to a prostitute. It still is written in the book. It was also an offence to gossip with another police officer. Is that still in the book? That was all written down in the disciplinary code. Yes,
no, it's all gone.
Gossiping
now
with a prostitute, and you could be done. One day's pay. Gossiping with another officer, you could be done. So you had to be very crafty when sergeants were around and you knew they were around.
So tell me the charges that Tom's charged you. More in Mayfair.
Yes, yeah. Now, in the poshest area around Mayfair, it was about five times ago, and they were around there, and the dolls of the profession. But the further west you, the further east you came into Soho, the lower the price would be. And round about, say, Greek Street, Fifth Street, Old Compton Street, it would be about £2 a throw. Round the main line termini, it was half a crown with one foot up on a dustbin. When you had them in court, they had to report to the court at 10 o'clock in the morning. And of course, they were sent down into the passage where the prisoners were kept as they had been arrested. And you had to stand by the Tom you'd arrested, so when she was called into court, you were with her. And they used to chatter around there between themselves and with the coppers, all very friendly while you were waiting to go in. And of course, when they came out, they paid their 40 shillings and they went off. But the majority of them were women you could talk to. Not that I had any professional assistance from any of them. Now, that was Tom's, wasn't it?
Now, what was you've touched on the discipline.
Yeah.
How strict was the discipline within the service?
Now, that was, it was strict because sergeants, now don't forget, there was a section sergeant, as they were called, on Bow Street round with 19 beats. There were three section sergeants and a patrolling officer who could be a station sergeant, which you don't have now, do you? Were they there in your day, station sergeants? That was with the three stars and the crown.
Yes, when I started in 76.
Or the inspector. And they would be patrolling, and so the sergeant's main jobs, as far as we PCs were concerned, was trying to catch a copper infringing one of the disciplinary code. So you had to be pretty crafty. They were much more desirous of putting a PC on the fizzer than catching somebody who was committing a crime. Some of the sergeants were okay, but there were one or two real right bastards. Real right bastards.
Cyril, we're getting close to the start of the war now. What preparations were the Metropolitan Police taking?
In 38, after the so-called Munich Agreement, we were issued with gas masks. Then, as the war approached, of course, we were told that the blackout would happen, that we would have to carry our gas masks, and also we were also issued just before the war with the steel helmets, blue steel helmets with police on the front. And as soon as war broke out, of course, then we had to carry our gas masks, and the with the straps, the steel helmet was fitted onto the gas mask, and you had to carry those around. All traffic lights, all lights went out, as you know. They fitted little things onto the traffic lights so that they only pointed down to the ground. And all motor car lights, of course, the headlights had to have these filters on them, so again pointing to the ground. And as soon as the blackout occurred, as Bow Street is, of course, in central London, and there are lots of office workers up there, there were quite a few accidents after the blackout because people were used to crossing the roads wherever traffic was and dodging in between. Well, of course, what they hadn't realised was that they couldn't be seen with these little headlights. How the hell? I never drove a car. In fact, I was 52 before I got my own car. So it must have been very difficult driving, and there were a lot of accidents for people who had simply tried to cross traffic and had been hit. There were those whose night vision were poor, couldn't see lampposts, couldn't see bollards, couldn't see curbs, and were tripping over and breaking arms and legs and bashing heads. Now, I was very fortunate, because when I joined the RAF, they found out that I'd got exceptional night vision. I could see things in the dark which other people couldn't, so it didn't worry me in the slightest. But it did cause a lot of trouble. In the Phoney War, of course, things carried on. The auxiliary fire service were chasing round with nothing to do. Air raid wardens were just lolling around without anything to do. You simply carried on normal duties as if there was nothing going on until...
Cyril, just could you tell me, where were you on the day that the war was actually declared?
I was in McNaughton House on that Sunday, listening to the radio, and I was due to come on late turn, because that was early at 11 o'clock in the morning that came on. And the first thing we did, and a lot of us, we went and got our steel helmets and walked and went onto the roof of the Northern House to see what was going on. And then, of course, the air raid siren went off for this false alarm. And we were standing on the roof there looking, and nothing happened. Then, of course, we went, duty was the same. The only thing that they tried to start off with after the blackout was keeping the coppers on point duty. They gave us long white coats, and we were expected to stand in the middle of the road wearing these, and of course we just refused to do it. It was absolutely stupid. So all we could do, we would be on a traffic point, and we'd stand on the corner of the road, and we would try to regulate traffic. But it was very difficult because they could hardly see us until the last minute, even though you're wearing a white coat.
Cyril, tell me about war reserves and special constables.
Well, of course, they'd been recruiting those before, I'd say a year before the war broke out. And they were given, the sergeants were doing this, they were going around recruiting war reserves, and they were given a certain number, and of course, when they were finding they weren't getting those numbers, they were recruiting anybody, particularly from Covent Garden Market, you see, half the costermongers and the barrow pushers from there were recruited as war reserves. And of course, when war broke out, they had to be kitted out wearing ordinary flat caps, not helmets, but they were given everything else, They were given WR numbers. And of course, during the phony war, they simply got in everybody's way, because they were you had to take them around on beats. Then they clogged up the canteen.
Were they given any training?
I think they had instruction lessons, but for how long, that I can't say, because we as professional coppers didn't think much of them, as you can understand. But when the Blitz happened, they just behaved just like the rest of us. And it was on the 7th of September, that was the day after my, in 40, that's right, on the day after my 23rd birthday, of course, they did the big raid on the East End. I was on late turn that day. When we came in for refreshments, we were told to grab a quick sandwich and a cup of tea. They stuck us all in tenders, and they took us down to the East End. I went to Poplar Nick, and we just hung around there. And then, of course, the sirens went off, and they started their raiding again. We were just standing round. They sent us out with one of the local coppers who knew, because the whole of Poplar, of course, was foreign to me. I didn't know where the hell it was. And they sent us out with the ordinary H division, is it? Or G, H or G, with them. And, of course, we just had to cuddle, shake down, hide around when bombs drop. But it was very frightening, I thought. And we stayed there, of course, until 7 o'clock in the morning, when they sent us back to our section houses. But we still came on duty that same afternoon at 1 o'clock. And then, of course, the raids went on. 57 consecutive nights, London was bombed. You were out on the streets. You were wearing steel helmets. You never took shelter in air raid shelters. You were where you should be, out on the street. The biggest danger, of course, was pieces of flak, which the 3.7 anti-aircraft guns, of course, when they exploded, they shot out great big masses of heavy steel where it was spread out, and these simply fell to the ground. In incendiaries, you were told, of course, that with incendiaries that you had to try and cover them up by using a sandbag, and there were plenty of sandbags around, and you simply stuck a sandbag on top of the incendiary to put it out. If it had gone into a building, if you could find the entrance door to the building, because it would have landed on the roof, and you would bust in the door and go up into the roof with a sandbag trying to find it to put it out. I was on duty for all, well, you know, on most of those nights or days. I was on for all the heavy raids on May the 10th, the very last heavy raid that they had. That was before Hitler went into Russia, of course, and it was a very heavy raid. I was on 10 Beat, where St. Clement's Danes Church is, and of course incendiaries hit that, and the whole thing burnt down. They didn't waste time on putting churches out. There were other buildings which were more important. So I was standing and I watched St. Clement's Danes burn to the ground. And of course, I now go up there very often for services, and with the Aircrew Association. And every time anybody's new who comes up there, I tell them I was here and I saw St. Clement's Danes burn down when I was a copper on the beat. A lot of the Arnold Association who know me know that story very well, and all my kids know it. It was frightening, but again, that you got the when the siren went off, you got the little butterflies in the stomach. But in the section house, I was on the floor. I slept on the top floor there, the fourth floor. It was pointless, in my opinion, going round down into the gym, because if a bomb landed, it would come straight through down there. So I simply went into bed and I used earplugs to keep the sound out. But we survived. There were, a lot of people killed, as you understand. And it would have been round about a week or so after the raid started that they started bombing anywhere in London. And I came on duty one morning, first early turn. I was told on parade to beware there was an unexploded bomb up in Lincoln's Inn Fields. So, and of course it had been had bits of barriers put round it, and I actually went and had a look, you see what it looked like. There's this bloody great big hole in the ground. I couldn't see the bomb, but that was the dark sort of thing that we did. You had a look. And of course, they, with these time fuses, they could go off at any time, these unexploded bombs. But that was the only time I did it. I kept well away from them after that.
Cyril, tell me the time that the bomb dropped very close to Bow Street.
I was in... I just finished my refreshments in the canteen at Bow Street. The air raid had been going on for some time. And suddenly... there was this tremendous rumble. Didn't hear the bomb coming down because it was coming down faster than the speed of sound, you see. And the whole building shook, wobbled. Bits of plaster came off the wall. The struts that they put up to hold the seats seemed to wobble. And the whole place was absolutely full of dust. Now, I was in the nick, and of course all of us in the nick soon put our helmets on and got out straight away. And of course this bomb had landed in Elders and Fife's, the banana place, which was which separated Bow Street. Martlet Court was a court about 15 yards wide, which separated Bow Street police station from these other buildings. And it was only the fact that there was this to separate that it prevented the nick getting a lot of structural damage, because the bomb had gone deep down into the air raid shelter and then it had exploded. And this is what of course had caused the problem. But as I said, I heard nothing at all, just felt the whole place shake. So, in theory, I was about 20 yards away from where this bomb had exploded, and nobody in the station was hurt or injured. But shelter, there were a lot of coppers around there, and I thought, well, I can't see any point in waiting here. So I went back on my beat, and Les Finbauer said, somehow got down into the entrance of this shelter and rescued a couple of people. Before the air raid wardens arrived, and then they took charge, and he was told to go away, but he was awarded the George Medal for his bravery in getting these people out. None of the others got out; they all died, and I think about 130 odd who were killed in that air raid shelter. So, I say, I was very lucky that we were all in the nick, that it wasn't 20 yards away.
What was the general feeling amongst your colleagues at this time?
Well, don't forget, when war was declared, all reservists who were still on the reserve list, Army, Navy and Air Force, were called up. You know, if you had served in the Army, or that you did 4 years... and then 6 years on reserve, and all those people on reserve list were called up. The rest of us, I would, it was, you were, we were in a reserved occupation. It was pointless to try and join any of the services. They would refuse you. And after the bombing and during the bombing, I thought, well, I'd like to get some of my own back. I'd like to join the Air Force and give the Germans some of this. But there's nothing you could do. And so when the police order came out from Sir Philip Gane that we could volunteer for pilot and observer only, then my application went in that same day, and so did the applications of a lot of my friends from Bow Street, and obviously from a lot of the other divisions, because we wanted, at least I wanted, to get into action, because although the police were doing a very essential job, it was something I didn't want to do. I wanted to get into the forces, and this applied to a lot of people. And also, don't forget, when war was declared, people who were due for retirement weren't allowed to retire. And so they had to stay on in the police force. And some, and when I joined in 1936, there were, of course, that was only 18 years after the First World War, there were a hell of a lot of ex-servicemen who were in the police force. And of course, that went up into the top ranks as well as ordinary PCs. And I wanted to get into the services, and I wanted to get in the Air Force. So when this order came through, I was only too happy to volunteer. And I think that applied to a lot of people, because I know a hell of a lot applied from Bow Street.
So you applied directly to the Air Force or through the
police? No, I forget now. I think... There was an application form which we had to fill in, and it went up to Scotland Yard. I'm sure it went up to Scotland Yard, but that was in March.
March 41.
But the point is, they were very, very quick about this, because I had to report to Euston House on April the 17th for examinations. Educational and medical examinations. So that was only about 5 weeks after the initial notice had come out. Somebody had pulled their fingers out there.
What form did this interview take?
At Euston House, well, there was intelligence tests. Then there was, you had to write a short essay, and mine was, what effect has it had that the Germans now occupy the whole of the coastline from Norway right down to Spain? What effect does that have on the aerial position? Well, of course, Europe said, you know, their bases were so much closer to us, the distance wasn't that far, and the rest of it, there was then these questionnaires where you're given what they call them, where you're given three possible or four possible answers.
Multiple choice.
Yeah, multiple choice. They were intelligence tests. You did those first. Then you had your medical. Then if you passed that, you were interviewed by... I was interviewed by a wing commander. And the fact... which is important for me, is that I played rugby. I actually played rugby for E Division and the Met Police, you see, and this came up and he was a rugby fan. So I had no problems in passing. And also the fact that I'd been to grammar school.
And what form
then,
did they...
Then you were told, I told there and then, by him, by this wing commander, that's okay, he said, you are now... you'll be called up, you're on the list of being called up, and you'll be hearing from us shortly. And that was it. And so then...
What was the medical like?
The medical?
Medical, do you remember that?
Yeah, oh yes, that was... I did a lot of swimming, because I also played water polo for the Met Police. And I knew you had to blow into this tube of mercury and hold it... this tube up for 1 minute. So I did a lot of underwater swimming to make sure I could hold my breath for that time. I practically stopped smoking. I've been smoking fags. I think I got down to about one a day to make sure I was fit. We also knew, of course, that you would have to know the Morse code. So all the coppers who knew where they were going, we all got copies of the Morse code. And sometimes when you were on night duty, you would see one of your mates across the road and you would spell out "how do" in Morse code, you see, hoping you'd recognise it. Ask things like that. But it was helpful because, and oh yes, on aircraft recognition, another thing which we knew we would have to do. So we got the copies of the books where you could recognise aircraft. And this is preparing ourselves so we know it would be easier when we actually joined and got to initial training wing where all these things happened, where they were taught. And I was, but that's about all we could do until I was then told to report to Aircrew Receiving Centre. And what data have I got in my... That was at Lord's Cricket Ground on the 11th of August. So I'd been from the 17th of April, when I was accepted in the Air Force, I had to wait until the 11th of August before I was actually... I was sworn in. We were sworn in at Euston House once we'd been accepted into the Air Force. We weren't given the Queen's shillings, but we were sworn in. And it was then that I had to report to Aircrew Receiving Centre, or ACRC it was called, at Lord's. And I was there, we did a bit of drilling, we had all the jabs, they took the blood samples, and we were in flights. Now, is this, am I going all right? This is what you want to hear now, is it?
Yes, please.
We were in flights. When we went for the medical, 50 in a flight, we had to go to the medical centre, and the whole flight had to strip off stark bollock naked. And then the first thing they did, of course, was you walked in line, and there was a bloke who, with a needle, a sterilised needle, scratched your arm. The next bloke got the smallpox swab, swabbed it on, and stuck a plaster on. Then you went across to... you were given the injections, anti-typhoid, and a third one. You were given three injections. They simply stuck the needle in, put the first injection in, then left the needle in, and switched the tube, put the second injection in, and then switched... to put the third one in. And of course, there were these blokes who were fainting, because we were all stark bollock naked, and they were, if you were near the back of the queue, you saw some bloke having his arm scratched, and then this thing put on. Then you watched these blokes having these jabs, and after the jabs, we had to sit at a table, and they took a blood sample. And they weren't the old-fashioned needles, they were these old blunt needles, and in fact the needles they used at those time, although they were sterilised, they had to be sharpened. And they stuck it in your arm, and it really was hurt because they were blunt as hell, and they took out quite a big, very big siphon of blood. And these blokes were seeing us, and they were passing out left, right and centre. I'd been made the senior man of this flight, because I was one of the earliest, and I'd been 4 years as a copper, I was the first to go in. So as soon as I finished, they sat me down, and in front of me was a Bunsen burner and a lot of ordinary sewing needles stuck in corks, and I had to pick up the cork and put the end of the needle in the Bunsen burner to sterilise it, and then put it in one pile so the bloke could use it. And I've been doing that until practically all my flight had finished. And I say these other blokes were fainting. We actually, when we got out and were getting dressed to come back to the flight, there was one bloke who simply was standing against the wall and he simply flopped down. He fainted. Smallpox didn't affect me because I'd had a very nasty smallpox injection when I joined the Met Police, and I was therefore immune from all other jabs. The inoculations made your arm stiff, but there's nothing to really make a fuss about. You still carried on marching.